Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me on the line right now is author John Smolens. He's the author of the book Wolf's Mouth, and he'll be appearing at the Calumet Public Library on Wednesday, September 27th at 6:30. And I have a chance here to talk with John and find out a little bit about his book and how he came to write about this fascinating story that involves POW camps in the Upper Peninsula. And John, I'm looking forward so much to hearing about this. How are you doing today?
I'm just fine, Rick. Thanks very much.
Now, are you an Upper Peninsula native yourself?
No, I'm not. I've lived here. I came here 22 years ago to teach at Northern Michigan University. Prior to that, I taught for 11 years down at Michigan State and a little bit at Western Michigan, so I lived in Lansing. So let's say the second half of my life I've lived in Michigan, roughly speaking. Prior to that, I was from the Boston area.
Okay. And so you're over in the Marquette area right now?
I live right on the east side of Marquette, yes, within sight of beautiful Lake Superior.
Before we get into the Wolf's Mouth, what other books have you done, or do they usually focus on things of the Upper Peninsula?
I've published 10 books, 9 novels, and 1 collection of short stories. Not all of them are set in the UP or Michigan, though several of them are. Probably the one that may be most familiar to your readers is a novel called Cold, which came out in 2001. And as far as I'm concerned, a wonderful thing that has been happening of late. My most recent novel, Wolf's Mouth, has been published by Michigan State University Press. And what they're doing is they're going back. I've been doing this long enough, Rick, that some of my books have been out of print for several years. And they are in the process of reissuing a number of those earlier books, both as paperbacks and also they're available as e-books. And one of the books that they've put out 3 titles thus far this year, and one of them is Cold. Another book that is set here in the Upper Peninsula is called Firepoint. And then a third book, which is set back in New England, where I grew up, is called The Invisible World. And toward the end of the year, I think right around December, January, they're going to reissue another one, which is called The Anarchist, which is about the assassination of President William McKinley. So geographically, I'm literally all over the map, if you will. But a good number of my books are set in the UP, and in fact, the one that I'm just finishing now and will come out next year with Michigan State University Press is a sequel to Cold, and that's called Out, O-U-T, Out.
Well, the Upper Peninsula, of course, offers no shortage of inspiration to be able to write. And a number of years ago, somebody had approached me because I dabble a little bit with video and with some film creation about doing a movie based in a POW camp that was put here in the Upper Peninsula. And I believe, if I remember the history right, I think it was Civil War, but I'm not exactly sure. And, at the time, it just wasn't something I was interested in doing. How did you come across this idea?
One of the most interesting things for me, when Wolf's Mouth came out a year ago last March, I've had the good fortune to travel really all over the state of Michigan and outside the state, often to libraries and bookstores and sometimes schools. One of the most common responses is people, particularly from my generation, I'm a baby boom generation, born not long after the war. People just say they had no idea that these camps had been here in Michigan, let alone in the United States. In fact, there were 32 POW camps during the last couple of years of World War II in Michigan. And in the United States, historians don't always agree on the exact number, but I would say the common number is approximately 170 camps. So it was years ago, and I want to say maybe 15 or more years ago, when I was living here in Marquette and teaching at Northern Michigan University, there was a series of articles in our daily newspaper, the Marquette Mining Journal, written by one of their longtime journalists named John Pepin. And he usually covered stories that are set over in the Munising area. And he had this series of stories about a POW camp that was in Autrain, which is a very small, you can't even call it a town. It's a hamlet, I guess you could say, which is about halfway between here and Munising. And it's on a small lake called Autrain Lake. And I was just fascinated when I read these articles. And, you know, my first impulse wasn't just start writing a novel about it. It's the kind of thing that as a novelist you sort of tuck in the back of your head and say, well, that's interesting, and sort of let it stew there for a while. But sometime over the next year or so, I began to do some research and find out exactly where the camp was, what life was like there, and slowly I came around to the idea that, you know, this would make a good story. And it took me a number of years to actually complete Wolsonoff.
Did you ever take the time to go and visit the location where the camp used to be?
I did, and it was a number of years ago, Rick. So far back, frankly, I'm not sure that I could find it with that much ease. But in fact, in about 10 days, a week from this Saturday, a group of people in the Marquette area have organized a tour out to that part of the woods near Autrain, and I'm going to accompany them. And it'll be the first time that I've returned there in, well, I would say maybe 5 or 6 years. Now, if you were to try to go out and find this camp, you would not find very much evidence of it at all. My recollection, and also I have gathered a lot of photographs off the Internet. All that you can see these days is some evidence of stone or concrete foundations, which were under the buildings, and in one case, I think there's a set of stairs. And occasionally you can see something that appears to have been some kind of wooden post. But, you know, nature reclaims wood. And anything that was constructed out of wood, really, it's hard to tell whether it was actually part of, it was man-made and it was part of the camp or not. So this isn't a kind of historic site where you can go and you're going to see replicas or, you know, restored buildings and structures from that particular era. The camp actually started out, it wasn't built specifically to be a POW camp. You may recall that back during the Depression, the United States government had a program called the CCC. It was the Civil Conservation Corps, which provided work for men and women around the country. And up here in northern Michigan, they had a number of camps, which basically were lumber camps. And so there was one that was built in Autrain. And then by the time we got into the 40s, those structures were what were used. They were adapted to some degree, but that's what was used to house approximately over 200 POWs who had come from the European theater.
That's an amazing background, just to start with writing a story. And, yeah, you know, as you're doing this research and it's and the story's forming, did you find individual people that were inspirations for the characters in your story?
Well, I think the answer is yes and no. The characters in the story are not based on one specific individual that I became aware of. I did find very helpful and interesting, when I really started to do research, there have been interviews with men who had been imprisoned in a camp, either here in Michigan or in other parts of the United States. And, you know, by the time they were interviewed, they were often quite elderly. And they were back in Europe. They were in places like Germany and Austria and Italy and so forth. And I found those really fascinating. They were very helpful. But I didn't use any particular individual as a model for any one of the characters in the story. However, I really did try to the best of my ability to make the story and the way the characters behave consistent with what I had learned about how life was for them when the actual prisoners were here. This isn't the first time I've written a novel based on a historical period. A number of my books are historical, and to the best of my ability, again, I try to create situations and have characters behave in a way that seems to be true to the way people were at the time that I'm depicting.
John, I'm a history buff, so I can talk about this from a history perspective for a while, but we want to switch it to a literary perspective and talk about your book itself, Wolf's Mouth. Can you give me a bit of a synopsis on it?
Okay. Wolf's Mouth is it's a first-person narration. The story is told in the first person by one of the prisoners who is brought from Europe to Autrain, Michigan. He's an Italian officer, and he's 24 years old when he arrives in Autrain. You know, one of the challenges for me in writing this book was because he's telling the story in his own language, and English is not his first language, naturally. You know, he's a native speaker. He speaks Italian. And yet, one of the characteristics of this character, his name is Francesco Giuseppe Verdi at the beginning of the story that's established. He's very good with languages, and one of the things that distinguishes him from the other prisoners is that he does speak some English when he arrives, and he also speaks some German. So he acts as an interpreter, a go-between between the different groups. Because one of the things I did discover in doing my research was that there was a language problem. Communication was not easy because so many different languages were spoken. So he comes to this camp, and he soon discovers that the tension, you might think that the tension in the camp would be between the American guards and the European prisoners. There was to some degree, but the real tension is among the prisoners, the different groups of prisoners. And there is a small group of German soldiers who are ardent Nazis. They were often dubbed true believers by their American guards. And they were very insistent upon all of the prisoners, all the European prisoners, acting according to what they believed to be the Nazi code, if you will. And they used very, really quite ruthless means to keep everyone in line. And this, again, I learned this from my research. This happened in many camps around the country during World War II. So ultimately, Francesco runs afoul of the German commander because he doesn't comply with exactly what they want him to do. And he's threatened, as other prisoners had been. And eventually he believes that his life is in danger, and he escapes. What distinguishes him from most of the other prisoners who were brought to the United States during World War II is he stays in the country after the war ends. He stays illegally. He changes his identity. And he's here for many years. So the story really transpires over nearly a half century. He's telling the story looking back on almost 50 years of his history. So by about the middle of the story, he has sort of morphed from Francesco Verdi to a man living in Detroit named Frank Green. And if you know any Italian, you may know that Verdi means green.
I'm loving just listening to that and wondering the things that he might be going through, especially in that camp. I'm sure you're probably familiar with the classic novel Andersonville, which is takes place in a Civil War camp, as I kind of referenced earlier, and those tensions between prisoners and the community, quote unquote community, that they generate themselves within a prison camp sounds very, there's a lot of similarities to there, as there would be, because those are historical happenings that took place in those POW camps.
Absolutely.
And Francesco's life oftentimes would be threatened, as you said, not by the guards, but by the people that he was interred with.
This is true. And I don't want to give the whole story.
No, I know, you don't.
Actually, later in life, I mean, the book begins in 1943, and he escapes right around New Year's, 1944 to 1945. And then about halfway through the book, after he's escaped, another part of the story moves ahead in time to 1956, and all of a sudden he's still a young man in his 30s, living in Detroit. He has a business. He's married. He behaves and looks like an quote-unquote ordinary American. But eventually, people start to seek him out, and he realizes that history doesn't really forget. There's an agent of the American government who becomes interested in him and claims that he knows who he really is. And also, someone from the camp, one of the other prisoners, knows who he is, and they re-enter the story as well. So as this American citizen who is just trying to get by, he's suddenly caught between these two forces from his past, and that's where the story moves through several decades, and his life is very much changed and altered because of what happened to him back in the camp.
You had stumbled there and called it a movie for a second, though I can very well see this as a movie because of the, you know, the content of it. It would make quite a thriller. I'm sure it makes for a just a captivating read as people are going through
it. Thank you. That's always everybody, or people often say this would be a nice movie, and I'm very gratified when I hear that. But for every novel that is published, the number of them that actually make it to the silver screen is very small. But it's nice when people say that.
Yeah. Now, your writing process, do you have to go to any great lengths to seclude yourself or check out of, you know, your teaching career for any great period of time while you write, or are you able to kind of do it fluidly and fit it into your regular schedule?
Well, for years, when I was teaching, I did have to juggle my teaching responsibilities with my desire to keep writing books. And I have to say that my job in the English department at Northern Michigan University, the two really worked very well together because I taught creative writing as well as literature courses. So the fact that I was writing novels really fed right into what I was doing at Northern. Now, I did retire 3 years ago, and I have to say there's no such thing as being a retired writer. I mean, I'm writing more now than I have in years, really. So the beauty of this is that I've gotten to a point in my life where I'm not teaching on a regular basis anymore, and I sit at the desk for a period of time every day or almost every day. Sometimes I will spend many hours at the desk. I'll work for a few hours, I'll go do something else, and then I'll come back. And quite frankly, that this is an ideal situation from my standpoint. I still visit classes. As a matter of fact, I just spoke to a group of young students ranging from like 10 years old to high school seniors. They're in a club called the Future Historian Society. And I talked to them up in Negaunee, which is outside of Marquette. So I still get into a classroom, but for the most part, most of my time is devoted to writing at this point.
Wolf's Mouth sounds to me like it's a period-based thriller, drama thriller. Do you branch out and write other kind of genres, or is that what you tend to feel most comfortable with?
I've never been real comfortable with the attempt to sort of pigeonhole individual novels as saying this is one kind of book as opposed to another. I think that in many cases, when I read certain novels, I say, well, it's got a little, there is a love element in it. There may be some thrilling aspects. There may be a murder. Frankly, I would hope that reading something like Wolf's Mouth, readers would want to read it because it has a combination of these kinds of elements. Some of my other books, for example, The Anarchist, which is about the assassination of William McKinley, I certainly think most people say, well, this is historical fiction, which is true. What they may not expect is that there are a couple of love stories in there, which, people usually don't associate with presidential assassinations, but this is part of the fabric of those events. I wrote another book called The Schoolmaster's Daughter, which is set in Boston in the spring of 1775, which is when the American Revolution began, with the Battle of Bunker Hill and Lexington and Concord. And in that story, I follow a family that actually did exist in Boston at the time, and which was divided between their loyalties. The parents were loyal to the British Crown, And their children were not only patriots, but they worked as spies for the patriotic cause. So my hope is that if you were to read a number of my books, you'd see that I'm trying not to do the same thing from one book to the next. To the best of my ability, I'm trying to do something a little bit different and be true to whatever that particular story and that group of characters are all about.
The title of your latest book, Wolf's Mouth, does that have a double meaning?
Well, this is another question that I get very frequently. The epigram at the beginning of the book explains, or it tries to explain, where the title comes from. You know, in English, we have a phrase which doesn't make any sense. When you want to wish someone good luck, you say break a leg. In the Italian culture, and I speak just enough Italian to get by, I've taught in Italy and so forth. In the Italian culture, their equivalent to that is they would have an exchange. Two people, let's suppose two opera singers were about to go out on stage. One would say to the other, just before they go out from behind the curtain, in bocca al lupo, which means I wish you to go into the wolf's mouth. And the response from the other opera singer would be crepi il lupo, which means I wish the wolf to die. And that's their means of wishing each other good luck. So for me, that phrase, which is spoken quite frequently by Italians, for me, the image of the wolf's mouth represents things that people fear as far as Italians are concerned. So that's where the title Wolf's Mouth comes from.
Is it strange the things that people who will read your book, you know, will take with them? So I was, when I said it's a double meaning, the two meanings I was looking at is, you know, one is, you know, the wolf is one of the animals that was used to represent Germany, especially Nazi Germany. Yes. And so, you know, in the wolf's mouth was your character in the grip of these, you know, German officers. And, you know, I was once told that this area, especially here in our Houghton area, there's a nicknamed the mouth of the wolf, because if you look at the aerial view of Lake Superior in one way, it will look like a wolf's head, and you know, the peninsula being the mouth of the wolf. So I was just wondering if there was connection there, but you know, that's just me kind of, you know, putting in my presuppositions already in there. But yeah, the right readers do that, so and I could explain that break a leg to you too.
a good title for me may suggest to a reader a number of different perspectives. And, you know, all of the ones that you just mentioned, I would, you know, I couldn't possibly think of all the ones that other readers would come up with. But in some ways, you want a certain element of mystery and ambiguity in the title so that it will sort of spark the reader's imagination. It'll say, well, what exactly is this about? You know, it's interesting you mentioned the image of the wolf and its connection to Lake Superior. When I was a boy, I can distinctly remember in one of my textbooks, and this is going way back in the early grades, and it showed each of the Great Lakes was represented by some image that had nothing to do with a lake. It was so that we could learn to recognize each lake, you know, being distinct from one another. And in that textbook, the Lake Superior was represented by a wolf's mouth, and that image has stayed with me all those years.
We're talking with author John Smolens. His book, Wolf's Mouth, is out now, and he will be appearing at the Calumet Public Library on September 27th. It'll be at 6:30 p.m. The Smolens will be there to answer your questions. You can have copies of his book there as well for you to purchase. Mm-hmm. Books purchased, proceeds will help support the work of the Friends of the Calumet Public Library, who is sponsoring Smolens' appearance there. John, if people want, they don't want to wait that long, they want to be able to order your book, how can they do that?
What I would suggest, anyone can obviously go to Amazon.com, and I wouldn't want to discourage them, but in all honesty, I do like to try to support independent bookstores, and we have a very fine one here in Marquette called Snowbound Books. And you could either go to their website, Snowbound Books, or if you go to my website, which is johnsmolens.com, there's a link for both Amazon and Snowbound. The nice thing about buying a book through Snowbound, because they're literally a few blocks down the street and I'm very good friends with the owners, is people often purchase a book and request that I sign it and, you know, include some little appreciation, or I'll sign it for as a gift to someone, whatever the purchaser wants. And I'm always happy to do that. So if someone would like a signed copy, Snowbound Books in Marquette is really their best option.
John, I appreciate your time. It sounds like a fascinating book. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.